It is the 22nd of September, and this is the fifth Privacy in the Digital Age class. And we're going to talk consumer privacy tonight. I don't really have a lot of slide stuff to go to. This is really going to be a very practically focused day, as much as we all always are. But this one in particular, largely because much of my practice in the last, really, probably 4 or 5 years, much of it has involved consumer privacy issues. And so what I want to do tonight is introduce you to some of the concepts, and there isn't a tremendous amount of general consumer digital privacy law in the United States. As I think we've talked about in the past, much of what we have falls in the line of self-regulation. And I'll mention some examples of that. So where this comes out is really more a question of overall consumer protection, which we've discussed. But issues like contract, fraud, sometimes computer security, and it all plays into these questions of consumers and privacy. Now, I did want to raise a couple of examples, again, because things change so quickly. This is an article from today on the New York Times' Wheels blog, talking about OnStar. Anyone here, a GM driver, have an OnStar in your car? Neither do I, although tomorrow I'm getting a new Ford with some sort of telematics in it, but hopefully not this. So I would imagine most of you are familiar with at least the concept of OnStar. It is built into, I think, pretty much every General Motors vehicle. And the idea is it is a voice network tied into a GPS, tied into your car's information system. So it's everything from one can get spoken driving directions to your car automatically reports if you've been in an accident and where, and then calls you, and you've probably heard the commercials on the radio or seen them on TV. So this is OnStar, and it's built in, and I think as with most of these services, there is a preliminary free period. Maybe the first year is free for new vehicles. After that, it's a revenue driver, so to speak, sorry about the pun, for General Motors. Until now, it has appeared. Now remember, OnStar is powered by GPS, by location tracking. That's how it reports where you are if there's an accident. That's how you can get spoken directions. It's not that it's a GPS unit in your vehicle, you may have one, but rather it is tracking GPS, tracking location information, and sharing it up the radio link with OnStar headquarters. Last week, says this article, OnStar sent emails notifying customers of changes in the company's policies. Some customers say two changes in those terms were of particular concern from the standpoint of privacy. The first regards what happens when a customer cancels the service. Until now, when OnStar service stopped, so did the vehicle's two-way communications system. As of December 1st, however, that will not necessarily be the case. Vehicles of owners who no longer subscribe could still be monitored by the system's still active two-way cellular link. And remember, that cellular link is not only data, it is voice, and it can be triggered remotely. The second policy change concerns the potential use of the data collected by OnStar, which includes information like the vehicle's speed and location, current odometer reading, driver seatbelt use, and airbag deployment. Under the new terms, OnStar reserves the right to share that information with other companies and organizations
Even data culled from motorists who no longer subscribe to the service, but who have left the two-way communications connection open. And as of the previous paragraph, one doesn't have a choice, or one may not have a choice. So what we have here is the potential for this system, which is embedded in a vehicle one has already purchased, to be keeping a live connection going, collecting data, and potentially sharing it. And you'd have to see this particular policy. Anybody have any problem, or at least see potential why consumers might be concerned here? You know, there are insurance companies, car insurance companies, that are currently offering optional discounts to customers who install GPS trackers in their vehicles, not for anti-theft, but to track their speed, to ensure so that the customers who claim not to exceed the speed limit by X percent get to prove it. But here, you're right. If I were a car insurance company, I might well want to access the data on my customers to see if, in fact, they are exceeding the speed limit, going for more miles than they claim, right? And then you have even more subtle things, like, oh, look, the car goes to the high school every day, right? My customer has not reported a teenaged driver, but yet the car goes to the high school every day at 8 o'clock and leaves again at 3. And my customer is not a teacher. What does that tell me? Now, what's the bigger problem here, though? Given that the idea of disclosure, policies, ultimately has to do with choice. Consumers are told how an organization, in this case OnStar, collects, uses, and shares their information. Theoretically, the reason to be told that is to choose whether or not to provide that information to do business with that company in the future. And you don't see a problem. Right? What's the problem? Right. You can opt out as long as you're willing to give up your vehicle. This is not simply a, you know, I don't want to use Easy Pass, so I'll pay cash at the tolls. I don't want to use a credit card, so I'll do money orders. Or I don't mind paying more at the grocery store. I don't want them to track me on my car. This is a pre-existing system in a vehicle already purchased, right? Where you are basically told, oh, what a horrible pun. Our way or the highway, sorry. Right? What do you do? This is where we have a challenge. That this is not merely new thing or, you know, new changes versus old and older customer. This is current vehicle, multi-$1,000 vehicle, where you have no choice. Unless, I guess, you could figure out how to rip the radio out. So you either damage your vehicle or you give in to this or you change vehicles. I don't know. Did you have a thought on that? I would imagine it's probably not just stuck on, you know, like my satellite radio.
So when you buy it, it's active, right? And it's basically just never shuts off.
That seems to be. Now, again, I'm not a subscriber. I did not receive the email. I'd be very interested to see what it actually fully said. But at least as this is stated, it seems to suggest that you won't have a choice. That functionally it will or it may be on, tracking you whether or not you're paying, and they may be collecting those data and using them. Yeah?
I would like to see what the email from them said. Maybe they're just saying, probably for your safety, targets.
Well, we can always ask the internet, it seems to know everything. Okay, so here's our OnStar website, privacy. Click here to download a PDF of the new privacy statement. See, I told you the internet knows everything. See, talk about privacy violations. Yes, I accept the Adobe Reader. Okay, here we go. Let's see. Okay, let's see what it says. Yeah, what's a data management company? Good question. It's not defined. All right, so let's see where it says. So where does it say? It's not clear. Hold on. Is this the new one? It is. Yep. Well, there it is, right up front. We've added more detailed information about the information we collect about you and about your vehicle, including how we collect your information, what we do with it, and how we share it. For example, unless the data connection in your vehicle is deactivated, information about your vehicle may continue to be collected even if you do not have a plan. Here we go. In addition to other purposes set out in the prior version of the privacy statement, we may use the information we collect about you and your vehicle to improve the quality of our service and offerings, and may share the information we collect with law enforcement or other public safety officials, credit card processors, and or third parties we contract with who conduct joint marketing initiatives with OnStar. Now, no. Is that an exclusive statement? Let's see if it says. When there is an active two-way connection to your vehicle. All right. Unless the data connection to your vehicle is deactivated, data about your vehicle will continue to be collected, even if you do not have a plan. It is important that you convey this to other drivers, occupants, or subsequent owners of your vehicle. You may deactivate the data connection to your vehicle at any time by contacting an OnStar advisor. I'm not sure I would believe them. I'm just, you know, let's see how it says with whom it shares, right. How they use it. Who we should be, whom we share it with. Roadside assistance providers. Emergency service providers, law enforcement, other public safety officials, our wireless service providers, your satellite radio provider, credit card processors.
Why credit card processors?
Well, if you're paying for it.
If it's deactivated.
Well, it doesn't say that. That just says information we're collecting, but you're right. Data management companies, whatever that means. And others as may be required to provide service to manage or operate the data connection, protect the safety of you or others, or as required by law. And it says, we may also share information we collect about you or your vehicle with the following. This does not include the sharing other than on an anonymized basis of the location or speed of your vehicle or your safety belt usage or credit card information. That does not say anything about driving behavior, right? Patterns, distance traveled. So the vehicle maker, our affiliates, vehicle dealers, satellite radio, third parties with whom we contract with to conduct joint marketing initiatives with OnStar, your fleet company if you drive a vehicle that is part of a fleet, your rental company if you drive a rental vehicle, and any third party, provided the information is anonymized. What does anonymized mean?
In other words, they provide the information, but they don't say who it belongs to.
Do they say what VIN it came from? What vehicle? Do they say what license plate?
It doesn't say.
Right.
See.
Right. Now. Okay, here we have a definition, so maybe. Is it as troubling as customers believe? I don't know.
Not yet.
Not yet, but we don't know. The real troubling thing is a question of choice or lack thereof. And choice is key here, is key to all of this. There are core principles about privacy and data collection, which I'll get to in a second. And choice is key. What choice do you have? In theory, you can ask them to disable the connection, but I don't know what that means. But if you decline to do so, you fail to do so, you're driving someone else's vehicle, and that person has not, you've bought the vehicle from someone and they haven't shared this nice nugget of information, your car is just reporting regardless of your decisions here. So that was one interesting development. I also thought you might find this of interest. Now, Google, when you talk about data privacy, whether it's personal information or behavioral tracking, you have to talk about Google, because directly, that is through the Google search engine and through a variety of different means, Google, the company, has a huge and growing database about you, about your preferences, about your behavior, about your location, and a whole lot of other things. How many of us use the Google search engine? How many of us have a Google account that we might log into on our computer or someone else's? How many of us have an Android-driven smartphone or tablet? I'll know Android users in the room. How many of you have another smartphone or tablet that has a Google application like Google Maps on it? Or YouTube? Right? Or you might use the Picasa photo tool, or a whole host of other things, all of them aggregating data about you. So Google was under scrutiny and was hearing before the Antitrust Committee in the Senate yesterday, largely because there is concern that it's really not related to privacy per se, that Google's ability to control its own search rankings may be seen as anti-competitive. The vast majority of people, Google is their first search engine, and they rarely go beyond the first page of results. So Google has algorithms that are designed to, in theory, maximize the value of the search results for the consumers. In reality, Google search algorithms are completely opaque. No one knows how they work. No one knows how to get. Now, people will tell you, or they they may charge you for, you know, search engine optimization, but that only works as long as Google's site behaves in certain ways. They change it for whatever their reason, and your site, your site, which may have been on the first page, is suddenly no longer on this, on Google. It's on page 53 of the search results. And you have no control over that. And they've essentially, while they haven't knocked your site off the internet or your client's site, they have all but closed the gate because people won't find it, or many people won't find it. So this was a hearing about Google's market position and what that might mean, but there was an interesting bit towards the end that I thought was worth watching. This is, by the way, this is Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, is being questioned by the Senate Oversight Committee. And this is Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota questioning Mr. Schmidt towards the end of the hearing.
I think this is, again, an excellent point. We do a lot of tools for websites so that they can understand how they're ranked and the changes that we have made. We don't, in my view, do enough, so I agree with your question there. There's a limit to how much transparency we can provide for two reasons. One is that our algorithms, the actual ranking algorithms, are viewed as quite proprietary. They're viewed as our innovation, if you will, and our great science at Google. And the second is that if we're completely transparent as to how the algorithms work, they will be heavily gamed by sites that try to spam us. And we've had experiences where people will latch on to some behavior and then essentially manipulate the index to produce a really false answer, which often is the butt of jokes and so forth and so on. So there's a limit to how transparent we wish to be with respect to our actual ranking algorithm. I do agree with you that we can do a better job of describing the change and so forth. I think that's exactly right.
Okay, just one last question here. You online users are in many ways your customers, but then also the businesses that advertise are your customers. So does Google need to be careful that the privacy and protection of the web users doesn't come into conflict with the business interests of those that are advertising on the web, and how do you resolve that conflict?
We debate this quite a bit. We have a very detailed privacy policy about how we behave with users' data. And there have been a number of businesses suggested to us over the years that would use, misuse people's private data, search histories, and so forth. And we've said no to those. It's very, very important that the history of people's searches, where they are, what they do, is not used without their permission in these advertising products. And I think you'll find that Google will be one of the exemplars of that principle. As this becomes a bigger thing for many, many companies, a lot of people will face this question.
Thank you very much.
Well, we are now going to transition to the second panel, and we thank you, Mr. Schmidt, for being here and for your testimony. And I'm glad that my colleague from Minnesota brought up privacy. I am the chairman of the Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law, and I would probably like to, but we'll be keeping the record open for 10 days. 20 days.
One day.
One week. Okay, it's either 10 days, 1 week, or 20 days. I'm the chairman right now, and I think we'll do 1 week, which I think is actually the proper answer. Chairman Nicole apologizes for not being here for the conclusion of your testimony, but was needed for votes in the Appropriations Committee. So we thank you. And since we're...
Okay. Did you guys know there was a subcommittee on Internet privacy and technology? There is. So this comes up, right? And I don't know. Do you guys know what we just did here, by the way? This is actually... this cool thing that very few people know about. C-SPAN, we know what C-SPAN is, right? So C-SPAN has put, and continues to put, everything it has ever aired on its website. And you can search by keyword. And then you could get to the exact moment in the hearing or the event that you want to. So, and we'll probably be doing more of this over the semester, the useful thing is that most of the law that we're looking at is new enough that it was on C-SPAN. And so we will be looking at more of the floor statements of the bills as they are introduced. As we talk about children's privacy in our next class, we're going to look at when COPPA was introduced. So, but just see that even in the context of this antitrust hearing, the issue of privacy comes up. And it should, because Mr. Schmidt was, you know, very, I think, so he's telling us that, and here he is, transparency and choice, and Google, okay, great. Google's privacy policy. Okay, so here are the privacy policies, lots of things here. Google services, that's nice, except, this policy applies to all of the products, services, right? Except that if you look at some of the mobile privacy stuff, it's astonishing how many privacy policies Google has. Now let's see. Postini has a different one. Privacy tools. Google Dashboard, Data Liberation Front, Keep My Opt-Outs, Encrypted Search. All these things you can opt out of. But think of the kind of information that Google has. This is what I was looking for. So we just saw Google's privacy policy, right? Applies to all Google services except. The following statements explain specific privacy practices with respect to certain products and services. Plus one button, advertising advisor, apps, blogger, books, Buzz, checkout, Chrome, Chrome Frame, desktop, Pierce, Google Plus, Google Notebook, Google TV, Google Web, Groups, Health, Null, location service in Firefox, mobile moderator, music beta, O3D, Orkut, Picasa, Postini, Power Meter, Safe Browsing Site, Store Toolbar, Traders, Translator Toolkit, Voice, Web Accelerator, Web History, and YouTube. All of which are Google properties. All of which are feeding into a centralized core. And to the extent that you have a Gmail account and you have a YouTube account that may be tied to that Gmail account, and you have an Android device or a mobile device that's using Google Maps, and you've logged in some way, and maybe you've got a blog in Blogger, and maybe you're using Google Voice, all feeding in. So when Eric Schmidt, what I think is, I'm not impugning his integrity, tells us and tells Senator Klobuchar that Google is transparent and Google makes its positions clear. Yeah, if you, you know, take the 5-credit course in Google's privacy policies. This is where we have a challenge. Because with consumer privacy, the issues, as with all privacy, but particularly when you're talking about information gathering with regard to consumers, you have to look at the channels through which information is collected, what information is collected, how it is used internally, and how it is shared. And from a consumer perspective, it's nearly impossible to get one's head around that.
People surprised by this? Anyone deeply familiar with Google's practices? Google has just a huge number of channels in. Not every business does. Not every organization does. Google does. So, this really gives you, this is the extreme. This is the notion of consumer choice, consumer knowledge. See if I can find this. Here we go. So where do we begin? What are the principles? What are the best practices, the guiding frame? What is the guiding framework for consumer privacy? Among the best statements of it, one that dates back, I think, to the 1970s, is this. These are the Fair Information Practice Principles that have been developed. This you see through the FTC website, and it's ftc.gov/reports/privacy3/fairinfo.shtm, or you can simply go to Google and search Fair Information Practice Principles, FTC, and you'll get here. What we have here are these five pillars, so to speak, five core principles of privacy protection: notice and awareness, choice and consent, access and participation, integrity and security, note that one, Francis, and enforcement and redress. So what are these things? This, by the way, is not law, what you're looking at here. These are principles, guiding philosophy. Notice and awareness. Best practices say the entity collecting should be identifying itself, the uses to which the data will be put, identification of any potential recipients for the data, the nature of the data collected, and the means by which it is collected, if not obvious, whether the provision of the requested data is voluntary or required, and the consequences of a refusal to provide it, and the steps taken by the data collector to ensure the confidentiality, integrity, quality of the data. Notice, awareness. So it's not simply giving notice. Best practices are that the consumer receives and internalizes and understands the notice so that the consumer is aware. You may have your own views as to how well what we just looked at with Google fulfills these things, because it should be clear, right? Notice, yes. Awareness? Okay, so that's notice and awareness, and you see that there are some... So here, in the internet context, says the FTC, notice can be accomplished easily, I like that word, by the posting of an information practice disclosure, aka privacy policy, describing an entity's information practices on a company's site on the web. To be effective, such a disclosure should be clear and conspicuous, posted in a prominent location, and readily accessible from both the site's homepage and any web page where information is collected from the consumer. It should also be unavoidable, not sure what that means, and understandable. What does unavoidable mean there? So that it gives consumers meaning and effective notice of what will happen to the personal information they are asked to divulge. Okay, that's the ideal. Choice and consent. Giving consumers options, getting their consent. Opt in or opt out, as it discusses. opt-in is we won't collect or we won't do this with your information unless we receive affirmative request or consent. Opt-out is obviously the opposite. We will unless you tell us otherwise. You may see references in looking at consumer privacy to what is called double opt-in, where you subscribe and then you get a confirmation. The more strident, or at least more, I shouldn't say strident, that's a negative word. The more vocal consumer privacy advocates and spam fighters don't look at double opt-in. That's not a phrase they would be necessarily using. They see it as verified. Or everything should be that way. It isn't. It's not required. From a legal perspective, though, I will give you one important distinction. There are times within regulations, within the FTC's regulations and in relevant law, where this idea of opt-in is not simply a question of opt-in and or consent, but it talks about express consent. For example, to receive marketing messages via cell phone text message. The business, in order to, for a business to send those, it must get express consent. Not just sort of casually, we may send you messages or we may share your number with other people, but identifying who the marketer is, what the kinds of messages are, how to get out of it, and only then, after the consumer agrees, is it deemed to have been express consent. So you have to watch out. There are times within the regulation where you see the phrase express consent. That is a serious, it's kind of like time is of the essence. It's one of those phrases where you want to stop and look and check how it's been interpreted because it's not simply a casual thing. So it talks about choice and how it's done. Again, these are principles. Access and participation. What does that mean? It means that ideally, not only should a consumer be told about the information being collected from and about the consumer, but the consumer should have the ability to see it and to change it and to fix it. Access to one's profile. What information do you have about me? Oh, that's inaccurate. Oh, I'd rather not tell you that. I'd like to give you more. Ideally, access and participation means that the consumer has an ongoing ability to see and fix and remove the data being collected. Reality is, at best, that's partial for most sites. You may be able to log into your profile and see certain things, but that doesn't necessarily tell you what else is in the database behind the scenes about your activities. Integrity and security. This goes to a point that I've been making with you having to do with why digital is different. Think of a credit report or a bank account. Not only is it important to know what's being collected, not only is it important to be able to see if it was accurate, but in situations where our information as consumers has been collected, it's crucial that it remains untouched. Integrity is that it is, the information is intact, has not been altered improperly. Your credit card number, if you want to give it, is yours. The record that you've put in remains the record. It's a little more ephemeral. So it says here that data be accurate and secure. To assure data integrity, collectors must take reasonable steps, such as using only reputable sources of data and cross-referencing data against multiple sources, providing consumer access to data, and destroying untimely data or converting it to anonymous form. The data should still be good. But security, and this is the reason I sort of waved at you, Francis, a few minutes ago, is we're getting back to essentially the BJ's wholesale case and the PetSmart case and some of the others. That even at the time that this was created, there's an obligation, best practices say, that data having been collected should be kept securely. As a general principle, in some circumstances, as with health information, there are affirmative obligations on the part of collectors, specific technological things they must do to ensure security. But as a general matter, security involves both managerial and technical measures to protect against loss and the unauthorized access, destruction, use, or disclosure of the data. Best practices say we need security. Enforcement and redress. What if they do something wrong? What if the collector collects things other than what it says? What if it misuses the data? What if it is lax about security? In order for these other principles to have any meaning, there needs to be enforcement, internal and or external, and redress, some sort of remedy on the part of the for the consumer if there's a mistake. Now, I think I may have mentioned to you that I published an article early in the year, finally, about spam filters and about the particular odd legal reality that if a person or a company is improperly put within a spam block list, placed in some sort of list that functionally blocks that party's emails from getting through, and it's done incorrectly, the party did not in fact fit the definition of the spammer, because of a rather odd quirk in U.S. law, there is no effective legal redress. So in a sense, those collectors of data about emailers are not fulfilling this obligation, or at least our law, and I don't have to go into it now, I'm happy to expound in nauseating detail about why that is, how it's developed, sort of an unintended consequence of an otherwise positive law, but enforcement and redress are simply not there in that particular data collection and use context. Note what our first option for enforcement and redress is. Self-regulation. Trusting the collecting entity to do the right thing, to police itself, to respond, to remedy. If that doesn't work, we have private remedies, potentially, and governmental enforcement. So these five principles are the guiding principles here in the United States especially, and these are fairly common across the world, best practices with regard to data security and data privacy. One more point I'd like to let you know about before we move on from these principles. You will see very much the same type of principles in the European Union's Data Protection Directive. The European Union is not itself, of course, a country. It is a political organization made up of member states. The way the Union establishes the commonality is it creates directives on all sorts of things. And the directives essentially are minimum specific standards for different kinds of laws that each member state must adopt. So there are directives with regard to imports and exports and intellectual property and antitrust and a whole host of other things. And one of them is data protection. European Union member nations must pass specific laws with regard to data protection, collection, and use. And they have a very different framework. Data collectors must register, must report. There are much more stringent limitations on the private collection of personal information by businesses. The Data Protection Directive adds one more principle to these five. Onward transfer. Under the European Union's Data Protection Directive, one of the things that must be prohibited by member states is taking the data collected within the European Union, pursuant to the directive, and allowing it to go outside of the EU to places where the laws are insufficiently stringent, that the protection is not good enough. There's a prohibition on onward transfer of collected data to data sieves, places where data leaks. And guess which country, with the country that, among other things, has a strong reliance on self-regulation rather than statute, which country does not rise to the level of sufficiently protective? So, what do we do about that? It turns out this is a problem. This was a real problem. Because when, as this says, this, what we're looking at here is the Department of Commerce's export division. Consider that you've got companies that do business in the United States and in Europe, and may be collecting information from Europe, or maybe sending information from here to there, personal information about customers. Under the Data Protection Directive, whether it's collected there or sent there, it can't come back. This became a real potential problem, because you have a lot of companies, small and large, that fall under this conflict. So our Department of Commerce negotiated with the EU and then apparently with the Swiss government, similarly, a safe harbor. What this safe harbor says, and if you look under export.gov/safe harbor, you will find it, is that if there is a company that intends to export personal information from Europe, either because it's collected there or it's sent there and they want it to come back, in order for it to be legally allowed to do so, that is, if it's a company that has U.S. Connections, the company must essentially promise publicly that it will do more than U.S. law requires. Not necessarily as much as the EU, but there are certain specific commitments that the company must make publicly. And it must put itself on the list that you can find on this website. And to the extent that it fails, and once it does that, it is permitted to pass information back and forth, as long as it's in compliance. However, if it turns out to have failed, then it may no longer be allowed to take advantage of that. So let's take Motorola Mobility. Motorola Mobility, oddly enough, is currently under acquisition plans by Google. Motorola Mobility makes their mobile devices. It's the mobile devices, cell phones, etc., division of Motorola. I think Symbol, which, at least the former Symbol here on Long Island, is part of that division of Motorola. So Motorola Mobility has put itself on the safe harbor list. And here we have an organization, you know, contact, corporate officer, safe harbor information. What kind of information might it be processing? And it has a whole list of the things, the kind of data that it might have. A whole bunch of things. A link to its privacy policy. What its privacy programs may or may not be. It verifies in-house dispute resolution. So notice, we have all of those principles here, right? We have notice and choice. We have redress dealt with. Integrity and security. We'd have to read this through. And so on and so on, so forth. And we see who might be the right person. I shouldn't forget this. Quick semi-related practice tip. There will be times in your career when you want to reach someone within a company, in the legal department. And you cannot find a listing for the legal department. Here's the tip. If the company is involved in media or technology, there are two places you're going to want to look. The first is here. The Export Division Safe Harbor list must provide contacts. And look here. Law Department, James Lyon, counsel, phone number, fax number, privacy@motorola.com is an email address. But suddenly, whether or not you knew that here's a phone number for Motorola's legal department. The second place is on the copyright website, copyright.gov. Another safe harbor listing for the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. People who own websites, in order so that they're not held liable if somebody else posts something infringing on their website, they must list an agent for service of process. And so I have had situations where I needed to find a legal person within a company. Could not otherwise, but either here or on the copyright safe harbor, you've got contact information. A little practice tip for you. So, we have these general principles. They're different various places. Well, how does this play out? Let me introduce you to cutefuzzybears.com, which I think I still own this domain because I started doing this almost 10 years ago and I realized I'd better buy the name because otherwise some student is going to put something really inappropriate up there. So as far as I know, I still own the domain. It doesn't do anything. But I created this diagram to highlight a point that I've made before. The complete and utter fallacy of the privacy policy statement that says we will not share your personal information with any third party. This, folks, is a simplified diagram of what happens and who is involved when you decide to send a cute fuzzy bear by mail to a friend. So let me, and this really came out of my experience as in-house counsel for an online retailer, seeing how these players interact, both in good times and in bad. Let me tell you, if you think that privacy makes this complicated, bankruptcy? Everybody basically has a claim. It's a nightmare. Story for another time. If I ever teach creditors' rights. Anyway, let me guide you through buying a cute fuzzy bear from cutefuzzybears.com for a friend. Here's how it goes. Buyers over on your left. Signs onto the internet. Connects through the internet service provider. Types in cutefuzzybears.com. into the browser. Or goes to Google, searches for it, Google just takes that off, puts stuffed animal ads up, etc. This is the third-party hosting company where the website of this corporation is stored. This is sort of the corporation. Requests a cute fuzzy bear to be sent to a friend. Oh. Cutefuzzybears.com being a typical, small, largely virtual corporation, doesn't have its own inventory, doesn't have its own warehouse. It's a third-party warehouse that not only keeps the stuff, but offers what are called pick, pack, and ship services. Cute Fuzzy Bears said, do we have one of those bears in stock? Third-party warehouse checks its inventories. Oh, yes, we do. Okay, fine. This bear is available. Would you like to buy it? Yes. Great. Okay. So how are you going to pay for it? I will give you a credit card, says buyer. Oh, okay. Give me the credit card number and all the various information. At that point, cutefuzzybears.com contacts a credit card processor and says, is this credit card information legitimate? Does it match? Billing address with the account, is it a real account? Is there this amount of money available in credit? Credit card processor contacts the issuing bank. Issuing bank says yes. Credit card processor comes back, yes, approves the transaction. Cutefuzzybears.com says, fine, we are going to sell you a bear. Takes the credit card number, goes back to the credit card processor and puts what is called a pre-authorization hold. Credit card processor tells the issuing bank, segregate, let's say it's a rather pricey cute fuzzy bear, $80 in credit. Don't allow that amount of credit to be used. You guys may have run into this. Maybe you have a low-limit credit card or a debit card, and you've made a hotel reservation or a rental car reservation, and you find out that you're hitting your limit and you haven't spent the money. What happens is that when you make the reservation, the company puts a pre-authorization hold, tells the credit card issuer, don't double-use this amount of credit, because otherwise you could charge much more than you have credit for as long as the charges don't come through. So the pre-authorization hold, and they're not permanent, but they last for a certain amount of time under contract, right? Cutefuzzybears.com sends the receipt through the host, through the ISP, to you. Tells the warehouse, okay, pull a bear, this bear off the shelf, pack it in one of our boxes, put this label on it, hand it off to the courier, pay the courier, or use our credit, our account with the courier, UPS, whatever. When it ships, notice to Cute Fuzzy Bears, it has shipped. Cute Fuzzy Bears tells the buyer it has shipped. Cute Fuzzy Bears tells the credit card processor, we now get the money. Credit card processor reaches to the issuing bank, says, forget about the pre-authorization hold. Now we need this to go. Issuing bank says, fine, tells the credit card processor. There's often a credit card payer involved that may be the same business or a different one that handles the actual money that will eventually flow here. Warehouse says, oops, we're out of Cute Fuzzy Bear number 257. That was our last one. Contacts the supplier, most likely in China, says, send us another bear. Courier comes, delivers to the recipient. Recipient is happier. Courier sends a confirmation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. End of the month comes. Issuing bank says, hey, we're owed $80. Issuing bank tells the buyer. Buyer says, okay, here's a check. Check is sent to issuing bank. Issuing bank then goes back to the credit, to the bank where the checking account is held. Please transfer the funds. It does. And that's if everything goes right.
Never thought it was so hard, complex to buy a bear, did you? Notice all players. And I said, this is simplified. That doesn't even talk about insurance, and it doesn't talk about a lot of other things. And the company that delivers the boxes in which the bears get put, and so on and so on. This is consumption. So when you say, what information is cutefuzzybears.com collecting? What information is from the buyer? Let's now create cutefuzzybears.com's privacy policy, just in discussion. We at cutefuzzybears.com take your privacy very seriously. The following describes our practices with regards to our collection and use of your personal information. In order to provide you with service, Cute Fuzzy Bears collects the following information from you. What? What information does cutefuzzybears.com collect from the buyer?
Address.
Whose address?
The buyer's address.
Why?
To ship it.
But it's going here. Recipient is somebody else. Why would it? It might get the buyer's address. Why would it need the buyer's address? What?
For the credit card company.
Billing address. Often as an address verification. Since we don't see you, we can't look at the physical card. We want to make sure that you just don't happen to have the number. We're going to ask you for your address. We may collect your address. What else is it going to collect from the buyer? Phone number?
Credit card
number. Good. Anything else? Name. There we go. All right. Anything else? We don't know. What's in the account? You know, maybe could be fax number, could be cell phone number, could be email address. A lot of possible kinds of data that are collected. Could be the IP address. Whether or not that's personally identifiable is another question. But yes, we will be collecting your IP address. Sure. Yes, but that's not the buyer's personally identified. No, you're right, though.
You said what personal information?
Of the buyer, right? The person with whom cutefuzzybears.com is having this connection is showing this privacy policy. How, through what methods is cutefuzzybears.com collecting this information? What channels? Think about all those Google things. Where and how is cutefuzzybears.com collecting the information? What?
From the buyer.
How? Electronically how? Where? What?
Through the internet service provider.
Yes, but it just appears in the ether. What is the buyer doing to provide the information? Typing it into what? Where on the
computer?
On a form on the website. Any other ways?
Do it over the phone.
Maybe call, right? Maybe someone calls cutefuzzybears.com to check on the order. If the information is, the call is logged, it's collecting information through the phone. How else? How else might they be collecting personal information about the buyer? What if the buyer writes them a postcard or a letter? Sends them a fax?
Email.
Sends them an email message? All of those possibilities. So again, if your website's privacy policy says we collect personal information through forms you fill out on our website, it's true, but it's probably not complete. You know how else they might be doing it? How does OnStar do it? By taking what you've told them, to what the buyers told them, going out to a data management company and saying, here's what we know about this person. What else can we find out about this person? Go to Experian. Say, here's a name and a phone number. Experian says, fine, here are all the demographics that we've collected over the years. So cutefuzzybears.com may be collecting personal information about the buyer from other than the buyer. Okay. With whom? What purpose, from what we see, does cutefuzzybears.com, how does it use that information? How does it use the information?
To,
from what you know?
To process the order.
To process the order.
To build the order.
To build the order.
To send the order.
To send the order. To provide the services. How else? Well, how else might it use it?
In the future.
What?
In the future.
Might save it for future transactions. How else? It might use it to send you marketing materials. Whose marketing materials? Its own? Anybody else?
A third party's,
right? Take a look. If you still get credit card statements by mail, look at all the extra crap that's shoved in there. Third-party advertisers. How else might QFuzzyBears.com look to make some money?
Selling lists.
Sharing the list with selected third-party marketers. How else might it use the money, use the information? With whom else might it, right? So that's how we might use it to advertise, okay? Provide services, get paid in the context of our business. With whom is it going to share that information, if those are the uses? With whom is Cute Fuzzy Bear sharing that information? You see a whole bunch right here. Third-party warehouse and supplier. So these are all service providers for Cute Fuzzy Bears, right? With whom else? Delivery service. With whom else? Right? Your service provider. With whom else? Right? Buyer sent you. We've just shared your information with recipient. That's why the word may is very important in a privacy policy. We may. Okay? Anybody else that cutefuzzybears.com might be sharing its information with? What if the credit card turns out to have been stolen? What? Law enforcement. Sure. Always reserve the right to share your information with law enforcement or as required by, you know, by law. Good. So let's see, we have notice, right? We have redress. Cute Fuzzy Bears might have a buyer profile. Here's how you can get the information. Might be changing the privacy policy. Here's how we change the privacy. What about state compliance? Not that I'd expect you to know this, but you should know this. Turns out, California has its own little law. California requires SB11 notices? SB1? Nope, wrong one. Try that again, shall we? Okay. You know what? Let's do it this way. It's going to make a noise, isn't it? Bandaroos! Why am I looking at Bandaroos? Oh, look, SpongeBob Bandaroos. Why am I looking at Bandaroos? I'll tell you why I'm looking at Bandaroos. Because I wrote the privacy policy. So here we have, look, following sets forth the policies of collection of personal use of personally identifiable information. Collection of information in connection with the site, APG, which is All Star Products Group, I think. May, very important word, collect information in the following ways. Through forms filled out by a user. Through information provided by a user in connection with surveys and prize promotions. Don't forget that. Through entries made by the user in blogs and other forums on the site. Maintenance analysis of web server logs. Email and other communications. Third-party databases. May collect non-personally identifiable information through cookies, etc. types of information, the following types of information are about the user, are among those that may be collected. Always give your clients flexibility. Name, postal address, email address, telephone number, cell phone number, IP address, photos, videos, referring site, and other technical information. Depends, you know, it's fact specific. Oh, COPPA. We haven't gotten to that yet. What we'll see next week is that knowingly collecting information, or next class, knowingly collecting information, personal information from children under the age of 13 is a pain. So if you don't intend to, you should say so. Okay? Use of information. How might we be using the information? To provide requested information, products, and services. To improve the user experience. To permit users to enter prize promotions. To enable users to participate in forums. In connection with the operation of the site. To run our business. For users to obtain information and offers for products and services offered by site as well as selected third parties. Notice. That doesn't say how it's getting to them. That could be marketed through APG or PenmeShare. In order to do the foregoing, APG may provide the information to trusted third parties, including but not limited to, another wonderful phrase, selected third-party marketers as well as third-party contractors providing services such as the operation of the site, etc. It also goes into law enforcement. APG also utilizes electronic and physical safeguards to reduce the risk of improper access to or manipulation of information during transmission and storage, but cannot guarantee the security or integrity of the information and shall have no liability for breaches of security or integrity of third-party interception and transit. Not what PetSmart said. Remember what PetSmart said when we looked at the PetSmart policy? Your information is encrypted. Nobody but you has access to it. No. You don't say that, because it's probably not true. Access to information, here's how, and this is what I wanted to show you. This must be in every privacy policy where your client has any potential exposure in the state of California, which essentially means, just about everyone. California Civil Code, section 1798.83, requires this notice. That California residents have the right to request certain information regarding how their personal information has been sent to given to third parties for marketing purposes. And it is required that the site owner provide a free of charge way to request that listing. To my knowledge, it's never happened with any one of our clients, but you have to have this notice. Either a telephone number or a postal address or an email address. Changes to the privacy policy. We can change it any time. Any such revisions will be effective on the date of posting to the site. They're retroactive. And if you should check frequently. And if you don't, if you use the site afterwards, you have accepted the changes. This is a model that I and colleagues of mine have worked out. It is designed to fulfill, hopefully, both the best practices and the client's needs. Because the client doesn't want to overpromise, and the client doesn't want to bind itself. One other fun little risk that companies face with their privacy policies, beyond the inaccuracies. We've talked about that, right? You say X, you do Y, it's a problem. Consumer protection, Section 5 of the FTC Act and the state attorneys general. What if your policy changes? A number of years ago, Amazon changed its policies. And suddenly, it was going to do more with the information than it had. And it was sued. And at the end of the day, the FTC settled. There was a private lawsuit. What the FTC came down with regard to as a result of the Amazon case, was the following guidance.
if the entity that's collecting the information makes a material, it's a wonderful word, material change to its practices, before it applies that material change to any information it has previously collected, it must seek and receive affirmative consent from every single person affected. Anyone who does not agree, yes, you already have my data, you want to use it in this new way, if it's a material change. If they don't agree, the site may not do so. And the likelihood of people actually agreeing is almost zero. Not that it's such egregious, but people are not going to say, are not going to even take the time in most cases to consent to new uses of their personal information. That's fine and understandable if your client intends a new use, as Amazon did. It makes sense, right? You have this, and we say here, of course, that we may make changes, they're retroactive, but we advise our clients when we use this format that if they're going to make a material change, they may have to go get affirmative opt-ins. And if they don't, they're going to have to segregate the older data, pre-material change, and the new data. Right, but that's different, right? That is not, if it were a material change, they would actually, if they were following the law, have to ask you to opt in. Not, you may opt out, you must opt in order to allow us to do this. But that's not the problem. The problem is not when your client makes a decision to do something new. Something that cannot be fit in within the flexible language that hopefully you have worked out. The problem is when your client has a privacy policy that is wrong and it has to fix it. Because ultimately, it's not just about changes in... changes in the questionnaire, right? Changes in the practices. Oops, I spelled that wrong. Hold on, I want to find my questionnaire. Hold on. The problem is when you go to your client and you find out what it has been doing, and you look at the privacy policy and say, you know, client, you disclose X, you've been doing Y. We have to fix your privacy policy. And guess what? The fix is effectively a material change. Is this my questionnaire? I don't know, I'm looking. Let's see if this is it. I would try to get it off my computer earlier today, but my computer was not behaving itself. Don't want to see that. That's actually someone's actual questionnaire. Let's see if that is too. If not, I can get it. I know where to get it, actually. So that's when you have a problem. Oh, darn it. Here we go. This will do. Yeah. Okay. Let me show you how we get to this. Scroll. My questionnaire. This is another. Here we go. This is actually what I do with my externs, but I'll go through the question. You have a number. It's a very painful conversation to have with a client. Say to a client, look, you should have had a corrected privacy policy. it doesn't accurately reflect what you're doing. Here's why it's a problem. We recommend that you fix it. But in fixing it, you are going to have to make a choice, either segregating all those older data, and I'm not sure by, you know, as of when, or you're going to have to get opt-ins from everybody. It's not a good conversation to have with clients, because ultimately, they're not going to want to do what you're telling them they have to do. And it's not statutory either. It is a directive from the FTC, and it's only if there is a challenge to it will your client be discovered. But that's the right answer. So, the context here is accuracy, flexibility. And so that gives you the notice and awareness and everything. How do you get there from here? Because we had this nice discussion, fine. But we're not talking about a real business. As much as I might like to run cutefuzzybears.com, I don't. The reality of the business world is that your, when you say your client, usually it is, your client is the company. Your contact at the client, maybe the CEO, maybe the CFO, could be the general counsel if there is one, might not know off the top of his or her head all those things that we just discussed about cute fuzzy bears and all the different ways that these data may be collected. Right? May not know everything. So what do? What we do, what I do in my practice, and what I would highly recommend that you do should your practice get here, is to develop a questionnaire. It's not my idea originally. There were a number of automated questionnaires, but what we figured out was our client, the person, our contact doesn't always know. So we're going to give them homework. We're going to explain why. We're going to provide them with this questionnaire. They will come back to us, hopefully, with answers. And with those answers, we can help them either create this privacy policy in a way that is accurate but, and legal but flexible, or evaluate the one they already have and figure out what to do about it. So I want to lead you through our questions and why they're here. These are the actual questions that I in my practice send to clients. Charge a lot of money for it. You guys get it for the cost of, oh wait, you pay more for tuition than they do for my time. So never mind. So what do we need here? We need general information. Hello. Corporate name. Why is that important? Because the policy is making statements with regard to a particular entity. This entity is collecting the information. If it turns out you've named it incorrectly, you're not disclosing it accurately. Sometimes your client doesn't know what its actual corporate name is. That's always a joy. Business address. Why? Why do we want to know what the business address is? Why is it relevant to the notion of a privacy policy? Any ideas? So we can send our bills? Why? Why do we ask? Why do you care what, state a particular company is located in? Service, but because there are different state laws. California, for example, which we've seen. So you want to know because there are jurisdictional issues. Are they elsewhere? If so, where? In other states. There too. Where is their exposure? Not only states, but countries. Are you in the EU? Oh, well, maybe we ought to think about data protection directive. Are you elsewhere? Let us know. What else? The name of the website and the URL. It's always good to know. What kind of website is it? Why do we care what kind of website it is? Why does it matter?
That's also what age group you are.
Because there may be relevant law because of the type of business. Are you dealing with children? Are you dealing with financial services products? Are you dealing with health? All these questions have to come up.
Are you selling alcohol, tobacco, or firearms? Are you giving particular advice? So we want to know. Is there an offline business? Sometimes the offline business and the online business are integrated. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes the information will be shared between them. Sometimes not. Unless the privacy policy says otherwise, the default assumption is that the information, not only will the information be shared across the business, but the privacy policy applies to the offline business as well. Even though offline businesses don't publish privacy policies, if the practices described are only the website's practices, you must say so, or else they will be imputed, they will be, the offline business will be held liable for them. So let's hear what that is. Do you know if data are being shared? Is this particular business unit or across the corporation? So we can be specific. Why do we care about third-party hosting? You know why. Right there is the we won't share with the third-party problem. But also, the question of who else might have access to the information. Are there other services? Email transfer. Oh, okay. We have to include that we're sharing your email address with our email service provider. Is there a written agreement? Does it talk about confidentiality? If we're making commitments with regard to your information goes here and no further, we want to make sure that that is at least an obligation on the part of these third parties. Are goods or tangible products shipped to users through postal mail and or couriers? Why? You guys know? Why? Why does our questionnaire ask that? Because, right. So that we can say, we disclose to couriers to deliver your products. Remember our little shipping guy for Cute Fuzzy Bears? Are there any other third-party service providers who may have access to the databases or transmission network through which data is collected and stored? Sometimes you hire people to manage your systems, and they are third parties. What specific categories of information are collected from forms, purchases, emails, server logs? Because remember, the previous, you can look at a server log, remember our AOL search data. You can look at a server log, and sometimes the previous page, based on a search engine page, has the person's name in it. So if you're analyzing your search logs, you may unintentionally be collecting personal information. Postal mail, telephone calls, faxes, third parties, anything else. All the inbound channels, not just the form, and the categories of information from those channels. Name, address, phone number, social security number, color of eyes, whatever it is. Dating sites. You get all sorts of interesting categories when you do privacy policies for dating sites. Age or birth date, COPPA compliance. Right, what happens to it? What else do you have? Data protection access control. We're not going to make real promises, but we want to at least be sure you're doing basic stuff so the FTC doesn't get upset. Are there locks on the doors? Is there lock in the software? Are there off-site backups? Someone, another third party that might have access to the information. Okay, client, how are you using it? Please tell us. How might you use it in the future? So that we can be as flexible as possible and therefore not have to reopen the issue of the privacy policy and make a material change one of these days. Are you sharing within the corporate entity? Now or in the future? Are you communicating on behalf of a third party? How? Do you then, even if you're sending an ad on behalf of a third party, are you giving the third party your list anyway? Are you providing for marketing purposes, you know, selling your list, trading your list, whatever it is?
Are you giving it to some third-party company to slice and dice and analyze it? Tell you about your own customers? That's a third party. Then we get to this notion of access, right? And participation. Can a user, if so, how? What form and format is it provided? Is it a form? Is it a letter? Whatever. Can it be corrected? Now again, these aren't mandatory. These are just best practices, but if it's true, we want to say so. Why do we ask about trade associations? Don't we have the right to free association? Said so in the First Amendment. Why do we ask? Anybody know? Right. Certain trade associations have their own self-regulatory practices. PCI, the Credit Card Processing Trade Association, has practices with regard to data. Are they law? No. It may be enforceable by membership contract, but they're not law. But we want to know. The Direct Marketing Association has its own guidelines so that if there is a trade association, we want to make sure, if there is a policy, that it's being followed. Does the client have a current privacy policy? At least one. Had a client with three. It was not a good day. If so, may we see it, please? To make sure it's accurate. How is it provided to users? If it's online, where's the URL? Oh, look, it doesn't match what you told us. And here's three more. Is it currently accurate? Oh, yes. No. Client will never tell you it's not accurate. But often it isn't. And how has it changed? Now, policy may be, the existing policy may be otherwise fine. But often, sometimes you come across a policy that says, if we make any changes to this policy, or we won't, sometimes it'll say we won't make any changes to this policy without your consent. That's a problem. It's not that it's illegal. It's procedurally going to be a challenge because there too, effectively, you have to get, your client has to get opt-in from everyone to whom the change will apply. Or your client may obligate itself to provide written notice, which means that just like Verizon Wireless might have done, your client is going to be, or like OnStar did this week, your client is going to be raising a big red flag, bringing people's attention to the new changes. That's why it's preferable, since it isn't required to send this written notice, generally speaking, unless it's a material change, to have built into a policy a method for changes that doesn't require notice. But if it already does, you've got to do it. Have there been any legal problems? Are you under, you know, with regard to data collection or anything else? Are you under regulatory scrutiny? Is there a consent order out there that you need to be extra careful about? Because they'll be watching you. When it comes to things like email lists, how do people get off your list? That generally ends up in the privacy policy, even though it may not be entirely a privacy policy type matter. It's just a good place to put it. It fits in. All right, we have choices. Fireworks, gunfire, thunder.
Cleaning person.
Really loud roof walker. I'm thinking Ducks playoffs fireworks myself. Or artillery. I'm hoping it's Ducks playoffs fireworks. Maybe they won. Right? Ducks are in the playoffs. Maybe they won. I guess it'd be over there, right? Okay, we'll see. That better be fireworks. Okay. So, list removal process, etc. Who manages the removal? And California requirement.
We need to have a contact info. So, actually, you've seen some of these. This one's fun. Reveal his glory. Because it wasn't one of my clients. But I can tell you, because it uses our format and some of our language, and you can tell because it says it's location website located at Package Shark, not reveal his glory. So the other thing is, you may find your best work used by others, and maybe it's flattery, maybe it's not. Bottom line here, hopefully you looked at these privacy policies. If not, maybe you'll take another look at them. Bottom line here is this is about disclosure. And where your clients will get into trouble, where companies have gotten into trouble, is not only not following these best practices, but in negligence, misunderstanding, not even knowing what they're doing. It is very low-hanging fruit. These are sensitive issues. You see, we get the New York Times blogging about OnStar's change. Ultimately, whether or not you're in privacy practice, you need to have a great deal of sensitivity for these issues, and we will likely see more law about them. All right? Next class, we'll do children's privacy. I will send you specific readings beyond the draft chapter, which is there already. Any questions? Okay, go see the fireworks or not. Have a good night.